even crafting loopholes in their policies to do that.
In an article in The Hill, which was based on your new report, Saul Elbein suggests lack of flood, fire, and storm insurance may be hiding the next financial crisis, because big banks sell all kinds of financial instruments and investments based on mortgages, and they assume that the home is insured against losses. But rising prices for insurance, if it is available at all, add up to more uninsured homes in America, and nobody is sure how many there are. So if many homes get wiped out by extreme weather without insurance, banks who hold the mortgages have to eat the losses, and if they lose too much, all those instruments they offered could tumble, as happened during the crisis in 2008. So coal insurance and climate coverage withdrawal could turn out to be a really big issue.
Yes, the risk isn't just limited to the insurance companies themselves or even just individual insurance consumers. With the 2008 financial crisis, one thing we learned is that even seemingly sophisticated companies can miss big threats when short-term profits blind them until it's too late. And when that happens, those risks can be passed throughout the economy. And one of the ways that insurers have been justifying their delay tactics on climate change is that they offer, you know, one-year contracts, which makes it easy to procrastinate by waiting until the last minute to drop homeowners or claiming that they're going to wait until later to drop fossil fuels when they become unprofitable. But what we're already seeing now in the homeowners insurance market is that the strategy, you know, not only underestimates the risks from fossil fuels, but also the long-term implications on insurance markets, your local economy, and then the whole financial system. And without intervention, the public could end up being on the hook for a bailout.
Well, speaking of bailouts, in 2008, the public did have to bail out one of the biggest insurance companies in America called AIG. But even despite that, now AIG, tell us about their investments and insurance in coal.
That's right. But about 15 years ago, AIG nearly failed and in the process nearly wrecked the economy because of reckless bets on housing and mortgages, and then ended up with a massive bailout of $182 billion. And then when we, you know, fast forward to today, more renewables are coming online every day, but insurance companies, as we're seeing in this report, are holding fast to their fossil fuel clients. So ultimately, you know, what happens when fossil fuels aren't profitable anymore, or they aren't as profitable? Concern that insurers like AIG may be acting recklessly with fossil fuels now, just as they did with housing. And because AIG is one of the world's top insurers of fossil fuels, it's particularly important that we know whether they're making meaningful commitments to really phase out fossil fuels like coal. And the good news initially was that last year the company announced a new policy committing to restrict support for coal. But when we were doing the research for this report, what we found is that even after they announced the policy, they renewed every coal contract that we examined. So that means that they insured at least 30% of all U.S. coal. So either they're violating their policy or the policy was pretty toothless to begin with.
About 45% of all fossil fuel emissions come from burning coal, and there are more and more lawsuits launched against fossil fuel producers for their role in climate change. Are these big insurance companies covering those damages from lawsuits, which could be billions of dollars? Or could we be suing the insurance companies themselves?
It's an interesting question because some of the insurance companies are actually already involved with lawsuits with fossil fuel companies to decide who's going to pay at least the legal fees for these lawsuits. And a lot of the lawsuits against fossil fuel companies that you've mentioned follow the example of state lawsuits against tobacco companies. And we know it wasn't just the government that sued tobacco companies, it was actually health insurance companies as well. And so it's possible that property insurance companies now are going to be looking at fossil fuel companies and at some point trying to, you know, limit their own liability for these types of payouts, or also looking at fossil fuel companies to pay up. But insurance companies should also be concerned for their own interests, because the Senate Budget Committee recently announced an investigation into why and how seven insurance companies, including some that were included in this report, like AIG and Liberty Mutual, how those companies are still supporting the underwriting and investment of new fossil fuel projects. So this could lead to, you know, more opportunities for accountability in the future. And ultimately, insurers can't have it both ways forever. At some point, they're going to need to pick a side.
Well, and maybe the public can pick a side. Are there some insurance companies who really have gotten out of insuring coal altogether?
There are a few companies that have taken bigger steps, like AXA and Alliance, but there's no companies that we're aware of that previously underwrote or insured coal that have now exited. On the investment side, however, there is at least one company in the U.S. called Lemonade that promised from their founding that they won't be investing in fossil fuels.
Now, we all want steel products. Can we afford to give coal used for steel, that's called metallurgical coal, can we give that a pass?
No, we can't. Decarbonizing the steel industry could be key to achieving our climate goals and keeping them reached. And that's particularly true as low-carbon alternatives emerge. There's a key gap here with the policies from financial institutions, including insurers, when they ignore met coal and their commitments. And in the case of what we looked at in the report, the insurance company Zurich was insuring a thermal mine via companies that primarily get their revenue from met mining, which is basically another loophole. So if we're ignoring met coal in these financial company commitments, that could also enable thermal as well.
Well, mining coal has killed thousands of miners due to lung diseases, but it's not just miners who are at risk. How do these coal mines contribute to public health risks far away from the mine site?
That's right. In addition to the serious threats to miners themselves, coal mines pose major health risks to nearby communities. The pollution from these mines can increase the risk of health problems like cardiovascular disease, cancer, reproductive problems. So it's not just climate change that's the only reason to be concerned about these mines.
Can coal mining continue without insurance from these giant companies? And if not, wouldn't state and federal governments step in to force insurance on the taxpayers, just as Florida did for flood insurance?
It's certainly becoming harder and more expensive to insure coal mines, and that's not something that you'll hear just from advocacy groups like us. It's also coming from financial analysts. And of course, we know that the fossil fuel industry isn't going to just accept this without a fight. This past year, there was a bill proposed in Texas designed to prevent insurers from even considering environmental factors in their underwriting. But even the insurance industry's largest lobby group, the APCIA, opposed this bill. And we're also seeing signs that regulators in other states like Connecticut and New York are moving in the opposite direction, issuing guidance to require insurers to address climate risks. So it's not looking too good for the coal industry here.
If tough insurance regulations push up the price of coal, energy prices might go up, the price of everything goes up, and somebody will die of cold or heat because they can't afford the energy bills. That's what the coal industry is saying, and they even say it in advertising and television. What do you say?
So the public is actually already dealing with extreme weather from climate change. They're dealing with wildfires, hurricanes, and other disasters as well. And they're already paying the price through their insurance premiums. Plus, the cost of adapting homes and infrastructure, particularly power grids, that's going to add up very quickly. So if we want to avoid extreme temperature, if we want to keep people safe and in their homes, avoid higher prices, we're going to need to get very serious about making progress on our climate goals.
Public Citizen is campaigning against coal mine insurance as a business at both the state and federal levels. Tell us about your testimony for a Connecticut state government hearing.
Sure. So as insurers demonstrate that they're not going to take enough action on their own to reduce emissions, the public can actually demand that regulators and legislators step in. And that's exactly what started in Connecticut, ironically a state that's often known as the headquarters of the insurance industry. So 2 years ago, Connecticut took the first step on this path by requiring their insurance commissioner to incorporate the state's own emissions reduction targets into its insurance regulation. And they noted that the insurance commissioner has to pay special attention to coal. But this year, a new bill would actually take the next step, and it would use a concept that both the industry and every consumer is already familiar with. Essentially, you break it, you buy it. Insurers that underwrite fossil fuels would be required to pay a tax on those premiums, and then the state would be able to use those funds to invest in climate resiliency projects. So if insurers continue to cover risky projects that fuel climate disasters and ask the public to pay the price, it's only fair to go back to these insurers and ask them to pay their fair share of the repair costs.
In July, Congressional Representatives Rashida Tlaib and Adam Schiff introduced the Polluter Portfolio Disclosure Act. What is the intent there, Carly?
Sure. So part of the problem that we're highlighting in this report is that companies are making big claims, and not just on coal restrictions, but there are also companies making big claims about going net zero by a particular time, including at least 31 insurance companies. But just like with coal commitments, it's very difficult to check them without the underlying data. And ultimately, it shouldn't require this kind of investigative report to find the basic details. We also know that as the risks grow, it's not just advocacy groups and the public who deserve and need to see the details, but financial regulators at the national level need to be reviewing this kind of information to make sure that companies aren't creating risks that then transfer to the rest of the economy. So the bill would require insurers to provide their investment and their underwriting, you know, their insurance data on fossil fuels annually to all the relevant stakeholders so that it can be reviewed. And we could ultimately see more bills like this, not just in the House, potentially in the Senate, also at the state level, and more efforts at accountability as pressure heats up on insurers.
So in the end, what do we want?
So for insurers, they need to stop insuring new and expanding coal mines and any new coal clients that aren't aligned with a credible science-based pathway to limit emissions. And they also need to begin phasing out existing clients that aren't aligned with this pathway and aren't making progress. But at the same time, we need to recognize that insurers aren't acting quickly enough on their own because they're not incentivized to. And that is when it's time for regulators to step in. And this is where local groups can actually have a really big say, because insurance regulators and legislators are typically used to hearing from the industry primarily. And insurance companies have been really successful in the past at weakening efforts at regulation by claiming that, you know, we just need more data, or they need more time, or the risks need to become more apparent. Basically, delay, delay, delay. But when it's the public showing up to these hearings, the public can say, you know, our homes are on fire and underwater, and we're getting dropped by our insurance company. How much longer are you really going to wait? How much more data do you need?
For those who don't know, what is Public Citizen?
Public Citizen is a consumer advocacy organization that champions the public interest in the halls of power. And I work within the climate program, which is specifically focused on climate-related financial regulation.
So we've been speaking with Public Citizen researcher and spokesperson Carly Fabian. She helped produce the new report called Covering Coal, the Top Insurers of U.S. Coal Mining. It's free. You can download it from www.citizen.org, or you can use links in my show blog at equalshock.org. Carly, thank you so much for shining a light in this dark coal space.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
Recently, President Biden's administration approved massive new natural gas extraction in America. This is supposedly for international security. The U.S. wants to keep the lights on in Europe by cashing in on the bans of Russian gas. There is big money to be made. So-called natural gas is just methane, one of the most dangerous greenhouse gases. Emily Atkins, in her great newsletter, Heated, says we need to relabel this fossil fuel to methane gas. Methane gas is responsible for at least 20-30% of the record warming we just experienced. Stanford's Rob Jackson says a third of warming is caused by methane, and the gas industry does play a big part in those emissions. Again and again, we've been talked into the dream world, where natural gas is the safer, cleaner way to power the planet, much better than coal or oil. But early on, Cornell professor Robert Howarth questioned this narrative. His team investigated and found fracking sites were releasing massive amounts of methane. You could see it in camera shots over the wells with specialized film. The leaks continued through old pipelines and poorly maintained storage and transfer facilities. They have to vent them, after all. Then cities like Baltimore or Boston, which installed natural gas in 1887, they leaked tons of methane through all their corroding pipes. The researchers found high volumes of methane pouring out of sidewalks and right outside a school. Since then, paper after paper showed, when you really count all the emissions, producing and consuming unnatural gas is at least as bad as burning coal. Biden and the broad public don't know or conveniently forget these facts. The atmosphere does not forget, and we are burning for all those sins. So let's review what we already knew in 2013, and it's still going on. Radio EcoShock guest Scott Miller from Harvard was part of a group of scientists that found real methane emissions in the atmosphere are at least 50% greater than the Environmental Protection Agency has told the public. They found leaking methane from fossil fuel operations everywhere. Listen in. Big Picture Radio right now with Alex Smith. Get it all, ecoshock.org. A new university study shows emissions of the dangerous greenhouse gas methane are much higher than the American government reports. Have artificially low figures protected the American cattle industry and fossil fuel producers? Joining us is Scott M. Miller. He's from the Department of Earth and Planetary Science at Harvard. Scott is the lead author of a paper just published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science titled Anthropogenic Emissions of Methane in the United States. Dr. Miller, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me on the show today.
There's been a growing concern, as you know, about methane leaking out of the melting Arctic, and that's why it's alarming to find the government agencies, like the Environmental Protection Agency, may have been underestimating real methane emissions in the lower 48 states. Why did your group undertake a new look at this?
I think we really came across this project a little bit by happenstance. It's really interesting that you mention methane leaking out of a melting Arctic, because that was really the first question that we were interested in. We had an undergraduate in our group, her name is Talia Havis, and she was investigating methane emissions from Arctic and boreal regions of Canada, you know, really cold parts of Canada with lots and lots of wetlands that emit methane in the atmosphere. You know, we have collaborators here in the United States that are also taking measurements of methane in the atmosphere, and I had sort of thought, well, you know, why don't we try to do a similar type of analysis over the U.S. and see what we find there? And I think a lot of the results really surprised us, that we saw such high methane emissions, and in particular that we saw such high emissions over places like, you know, Texas and Oklahoma in the U.S.
And you measured those from planes and high towers, that sort of thing?
Yep, that's correct. So our colleagues at NOAA, which is the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and DOE, the Department of Energy, take these measurements of methane gas in the atmosphere. So they take air samples from the top of telecommunications towers, and a lot of these towers are the height of the Empire State Building or taller. So they're really high up there in the atmosphere, or rather high up above the ground. And we also take air samples from airplanes and measure methane gas in those samples. So the sort of principle or the idea behind our study is that all methane that's emitted at the surface eventually goes into the atmosphere. So when we're measuring methane gas concentrations in the atmosphere, we're really seeing the amalgamated signal of methane gas emissions over a regional scale. And, you know, using these measurements of methane gas in the atmosphere, we can get a pretty good estimate of total emissions of the gas over, say, a region or over the entire United States.
And the bottom line is, how much more methane is America emitting than the EPA reports?
Our estimate of methane gas emissions is 1.5 times that of the U.S. EPA. And I'll give you a little bit more context on that number. The states of California and Massachusetts, for example, have required reductions in greenhouse gas emissions. And both states are requiring about a 15% reduction from current levels by the year 2020. In contrast, you know, the discrepancy between our study and the U.S. EPA's estimate is more along the lines of 50%, and 50% is a whole lot greater than 15%.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Alex returns with Harvard's Dr. Scott Miller on gas leaks.
A best of Radio EcoShock replay. Well, Scott, why don't we break this down a bit? I know many of my listeners suspect fracking is a major source. Were you able to determine that?
Unfortunately, we were not able to get a specific number of methane from fracking. And I know that's really been an issue that's been a point of public debate recently. When we measure methane gas in the atmosphere, we're measuring the accumulated effect of all methane emissions over a broad region. And so that means that we get a pretty good idea of total methane emissions, but on the other hand, it means that we can't really tell whether, you know, most of that gas is coming from a certain cattle farm or a certain oil and gas facility or from a certain landfill. We just see the effect of all of these different sources together.
Do the south central states like Louisiana or Texas or Oklahoma show up more on the methane map than other places?
Yeah, you've really hit on, I think, one thing that we found most striking about our results. We find the highest emissions of methane gas in the atmosphere over places like Texas, Oklahoma, Louisiana, and Kansas. A former PhD student in our group had used some methane measurements from aircraft a few years ago. His name is Eric Court. And in a 2008 study, he estimated total methane gas emissions over the United States. And we sort of had a good idea from his study that total U.S. methane emissions were higher than estimates from the EPA. But what we've really learned from this study, which I think is new and surprised all of us, is how important the states of Texas, Oklahoma, Louisiana, and Kansas are in U.S. methane emissions. And in fact, Texas, Oklahoma, and Kansas alone account for about a quarter of all U.S. methane emissions in our estimate.
Well, beyond fracking, there's a ton of refining in the states like Texas. We have a listing of their emissions in that global methane inventory called EDGAR. Are those numbers accurate?
You're correct. There is a lot of refining in these states, and particularly in Texas, like you point out. Using our methodology, we get some idea that ruminants, and that refers to cows and sheep, and also the oil and gas industries as a whole, are probably part of the big discrepancy in methane emissions over places like Texas and Oklahoma. But we don't really get specific information about refining. The reason why we think that the oil and gas industries as a whole are important contributors is because of a really important gas called propane that we're able to measure in the atmosphere. So our colleagues at NOAA measure methane, as we had talked about before, but they also measure gas in the atmosphere called propane. And it turns out that propane is a product of the oil and gas industries, but it's not produced by cows, it's not produced by wetlands, it's not produced by most other emitters. And it turns out that in places like Texas and Oklahoma, when we see high propane levels in the atmosphere, we also see high methane levels in the atmosphere. And similarly, when we see low propane levels, we also see low methane levels. So we think that the oil and gas industries as a whole are an important player in these regions in Texas and Oklahoma. But, you know, whether those emissions are coming from refineries or from the well sites, it's not entirely clear.
And as you point out, it's not just fossil fuels. The cattle industry is a well-known source of this super greenhouse gas methane. Can you talk to us about that?
So the United States Environmental Protection Agency estimates greenhouse gas emissions in the United States. And they update their estimate every year. And some years they list ruminants, cows and sheep, for example, and manure management as being the largest source of methane in the U.S. And other years they list the oil and gas industries as being the largest source of methane in the United States. So these two sources are really competing for being the dominant sources of methane in the U.S. most likely. And we think that the amount of methane coming out of cows is much higher than what existing emissions inventories have estimated. And here's why. We estimate methane emissions over all of the U.S. And in particular, we can focus in on places that have a lot of cows, but that don't have a whole lot of other methane-emitting activities. States like South Dakota, Nebraska, Iowa, Minnesota, and Wisconsin, all of those places have a lot of cows, but obviously not a lot of oil or gas drilling or a whole lot of people that might be producing methane. And in those areas, we see about twice the amount, or we estimate about twice the amount of methane emissions than in existing emissions inventories. And so that would lead us to believe that there's probably some sort of discrepancy with cows.
And as your paper points out, the EPA recently reduced its estimates of emissions from the natural gas industry. Was that the right move?
That's a really good question. Our estimate of methane, total methane emissions over the United States is much, much higher than U.S. EPA's estimate. It's hard to conceive how EPA's recent downward revision in methane emissions would be consistent with the actual measurements of methane that we've taken in the atmosphere. So we don't think that it was the right move. Again, we don't have specific information in our report on the natural gas industry, but it's hard to imagine how this reduction from EPA could be consistent with what we're actually seeing in the atmosphere.
Well, the cows would have to be producing a lot to get the extra that you found. Okay, this is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We are talking methane emissions from America, the new numbers in a scientific study. Our guest is Harvard's Scott Miller. Scott, your paper lists methane as the second most important greenhouse gas forced into the atmosphere by human activity. And you say it is, quote, approximately one-third the total radiative forcing of carbon dioxide. Could you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, so when we're sort of thinking about greenhouse gases and climate change in general, there are a lot of different players and a lot of different actors. You know, there are a number of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. You know, one of them obviously being carbon dioxide, another is methane. Another one that's commonly talked about is another gas called nitrous oxide. But out of all the different greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, long-lived greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide in particular is of primary concern. And the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, estimates that methane globally has about one-third the contribution to climate change as carbon dioxide. One particular acute health hazard in many places in the United States and throughout the world is surface-level ozone. Ozone way up in the atmosphere is, in the stratosphere, is very beneficial, but down at the surface, where humans actually live, ozone can be much more damaging to human health. Ozone can be produced by a bunch of different chemicals in the atmosphere. For example, one important player, or one of the most important players, are nitrogen-containing compounds that are released by cars and trucks and many other human sources that are found throughout big cities in the United States. But it turns out that methane can also interact with this sort of big complicated chemical cycle in order to produce more ozone. A lot of times we usually think of, you know, the chemicals coming out of cars and trucks as being most important in this sort of health hazard. Methane can also play a role. It's not as big of a role, but it's still an important role.
Scott, I mentioned fears of Arctic methane emissions, but Dr. David Archer on this program, he's from the University of Chicago, he continues to say methane from the subtropics, including the United States, is a larger threat. Can you put your findings in context with global emissions?
There are a number of different sources of methane globally. For example, at the global scale, you know, wetlands are thought to be a really important source of methane to the atmosphere. And there are a number of different anthropogenic sources of methane, for example, coal mines, for example, landfills or wastewater treatment facilities. But in sum total, we think that anthropogenic sources, a.k.a. human-related sources, probably account for 50 to 65% of the global methane budget. And those are numbers taken from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. But I think that there's still an extremely large amount of uncertainty on, you know, how much methane might be coming from different types of sources, for example, from the Arctic versus from the subtropics versus from wetlands, you know, compared to the oil and gas industry. You know, I think this high level of uncertainty is one thing that our study really pinpoints and really, really emphasizes. I think at the moment I would be hesitant to compare Arctic methane emissions against the subtropics because I think that there's really still a lot that we just don't know.
It does make me wonder, your paper, whether other countries, including Russia, are understating their releases from the natural gas industry. But then I had to ask myself, does Russia even publish such a statistic?
It's also really interesting that you mention Russia, because back in the early 1990s, we saw globally a pause in the increase of methane gas in the atmosphere. And why the changes in methane gas paused in the 1990s globally is really a scientific question that's received a lot of debate, but a lot of people think that it could have been due to changes in methane emissions from Russia, changes associated with the fall of the Soviet Union, and you know how that might have affected natural gas infrastructure and infrastructure there.
Right. Well, as you point out, America is one of the most documented places for things like methane, but I'm betting countries on the verge of a fracking bonanza, like the United Kingdom, for example, have been quoting these lower-than-reality figures provided by the EPA. And, well, my next question, maybe you can't comment about it as a scientist, but the rest of us do suspect the government may be influenced by the fossil fuel and cattle industries to lowball the methane emissions. Do you personally have the same misgivings?
That's a really good question, and I don't really share a lot of those misgivings. And I would say that it's actually really, really hard to put together these emissions inventories of greenhouse gases. Places like the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and EDGAR, EDGAR is an emissions inventory that's put out by a research center at the European Commission, they basically use an accounting-type measure in order to make up an estimate of methane and greenhouse gas emissions. For example, they'll count up the total number of cows around the United States and in Europe, the total number of oil and gas facilities, total number of landfills, and then try to estimate what are known as emissions factors. So what do we think is the average amount of methane produced by an average cow on a given day, or the amount of methane produced by an average gas facility or average oil facility? You multiply these numbers together, and that add up all of the different parts in order to get a total methane emissions estimate for the United States or for whatever country that you're dealing with. And it turns out doing this is a really, really, really hard problem. You know, it's really hard to count up the total number of cows across the United States or get a strong sense of exactly how much, you know, natural gas is being produced. Natural gas, for example, is information is collected by individual states, and different states have different reporting guidelines. So I think we have to give them credit for, you know, people, places like the EPA, give them some credit for tackling a problem that is really the impossible, trying to answer something, you know, a question that in a sense is really, really difficult for anyone to have an answer to.
Well, I think I like your approach a lot better. I mean, what really matters is how much methane is there in the atmosphere, and if we can measure it in the atmosphere, then we're going to be better off. I'm wondering, during this study or even thinking about these results, did you come across real-world ways we could be reducing methane emissions in order to stave off even more warming?
I don't think our study really gives many specific tips or information as to how we could be reducing methane, but I think that one really important implication that it points out is how uncertain our estimates of greenhouse gas emissions really are. And as I pointed out before, our uncertainty on greenhouse gas emissions is much, much, much higher than the demands of current greenhouse gas reduction policies. If we want to understand greenhouse gas emissions to the extent that's required by proposed regulations, then we really need a whole lot more measurements of methane gas in the atmosphere than we have. And we also really need a really close collaboration between people like myself who do these top-down studies and people like the U.S. EPA and those who construct the EDGAR inventory in order to really bridge those bottom-up accounting-type methods with the type of top-down studies that we use. And in the U.S., for example, as I pointed out, we have 10 of these, you know, tall towers where we measure methane. But for a place that's the size of the United States, 10 really isn't a whole lot. And so we'd really like to have many more measurements to at least estimate greenhouse gas emissions to the extent required by policy.
Okay. Our guest has been Dr. Scott Miller from the Earth and Planetary Sciences at Harvard University. He's part of a team of scientists who just published an important paper showing American government statistics on methane emissions do not reflect what is actually leaking into the atmosphere. You can find a link to that in my show blog. Thank you, Dr. Miller.
And thanks again for having me.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. Past events with big damages, changes, and impacts on the mental health of people disappear down the rabbit hole of the latest disaster, and they come even faster. Let's step back, where UK photojournalist Robert Leslie revisited the U.S. South years after the mega hurricane Katrina flooded New Orleans and demolished coastal towns. We never see or document the after effects, the long life of major events, but Robert Leslie does. Remember prosperity in the new American South? Factories opening, people moving down into the real estate boom? Fortunes may still be made there, but for many people, the system shows signs of eroding away. Robert Leslie is part of a team of artists, writers, and photographers who explored the underbelly of that dream. The result is called Storm Belt. It's a journey across the southern states. Robert Leslie, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm glad that you have seen the project and have interest in it.
So you're British and sort of Canadian. Why did you choose to chronicle the great strip from Miami to Los Angeles?
Well, it was somewhat unexpected. I'd spent through 2007, 2008, I'd done quite a few projects in China. Principally, the last thing I did was on a big, for a French museum of architecture, I did a project on the development of Chinese urbanization. Having had some exposure to the U.S. in the 70s, when I was based in Canada, I'd never been back over with a camera to take a look at it. So for me, it was an opportunity, fresh from seeing the development of the infrastructure of how China is being built up. I had a couple of months spare time, and everything just fell into place for me to go off and do this exploration to take a look at the world superpower, which, as I say, in the context of just coming from China, was quite astonishing to see what I saw.
We will get to the drought, the storms, and the natural signs, but let's start with the economy. What are some features you noticed in southern decline?
Well, I've done the journey twice. I started the day that Obama became president in Miami, and then I went back at the end of 2011. The initial first third of the trip was much more perspective on the economy because it was the height of the recession, particularly in Miami and throughout Florida, just the number of second homes that were all up for sale. There was an endless amount of holiday homes just completely like make us an offer. And then also going through shopping malls and the parking lots, seeing guys with signs in the entranceway that basically read, "We'll do anything for money." The other thing I kept seeing everywhere was sort of endless improvised yard sales or sales of household materials along the roadside being sold out of vans and such. It was pretty well relentless. There wasn't a day that I didn't see anything like that, that's for sure.
Well, let's move on to Texas. I know Dallas and Houston may do well, but what about rural Texas? What did you find there?
The thing that really struck me about Texas was the amount of abandoned materials. I could find boats in the middle of a field, cars, homes. You know, I had driven past a home, and I'm quite wary of laws about trespassing and all that type of thing. And there's a place that looked like it had been empty for years, and I just thought I'd poke around to take a quick look in it. And I was quite stunned because it's as if the family just got up and left, say, in 1983. There was an Apple computer sort of melted into the floorboards, one of the first Macintoshes. They were an extremely literary family. Amazing books of the children's books of the people who built America, other historical books of the story of America, and then all the father suits all hanging up. And it was just strange to see that there was just this amount of abandonment. And I guess what I started to feel was that there was a real sense of like an abandonment of, I guess, the dream or the community or the hope. And I found this really ironic in light of my starting day was the day of Obama's inauguration, and I was in an amphitheater where there was a projection, and the room was just electric with hope and change and excitement. But walk a few blocks down the street in Miami, and then as I saw across the country, it was quite a different story than I saw.
It seems like we could measure the turning of the American South with every great storm. What about Mississippi and Louisiana? Do you feel they really recovered from Hurricane Katrina?
Well, it's interesting. I went back, like I say, the end of 2011, and I had the possibility to meet a few key people. There's a chap, Bill Stallworth, who was instrumental in the rebuilding of Biloxi. But then I'd also talk with people at shopping centers, galleries, streets, just to see how they viewed Katrina and its impact on New Orleans specifically. I was really kind of invigorated by the degree of zeal that people thought that it was actually going to be a good thing, that it was going to make it a stronger city, that it was going to make things more focused. Not everybody had that opinion, but I was really quite surprised by the stubborn determination of people to try to say, okay, we're going to try to fix this up. And I really wasn't expecting that. I didn't see that everywhere. I saw an awful lot of decimated houses and towns that hadn't really been touched in the 4 or 5 years since Katrina. But the thing that left this unexpectedly positive impact on me was the conversations with people there.
Well, we know in the future, Robert Leslie, that the sea level will rise due to climate change and we'll have bigger storm surges. I kind of doubt Galveston can come back the way it was, or that Miami, that you mentioned, can survive the constant flooding of streets, which are still happening day to day. What's your opinion of that?
It's funny. I think somewhere along the way I may have mentioned that I was connected with the TED organization, and they had a section called TED Fellows, and in there's a great British researcher named Rachel Armstrong, and she's spent a lot of the last 5 years in Venice trying to come up with ecological systems that can help protect that city from being flooded annually. Yeah, we were aware with melting ice flows that coastal areas will be affected, and it's just strange to see. I always recall sort of histories of indigenous peoples in North and South America sort of avoiding coastal areas because of floods from running waters down the mountains, wiping out villages that might be on the seaside, or the impact of storms. So I think historically indigenous people have had experiences on how they develop things, but I think all of that was quite overlooked with the rush to modernization and packing as many beach and holiday homes on the coastlines as possible.
And on the other hand, we can hardly talk about Texas without the great drought that is almost permanent. In a video for this work, I saw a single cow lost in the grassless desert amongst the power transmission lines, and I had this awful vision that maybe the oil derricks and refineries will just go on even after nature fails.
Well, in the ebook version of the book, there's a couple of ghostly scenes, but one of them is just a single oil pump pumping with the sound of like a Harley-Davidson motorcycle engine rumbling. Now, the location of that pump was where the storms Ike and Gustav hit it in late 2008 that totally decimated, eliminated all residential areas, schools, shops, everything. And the only things remaining were the oil pumps. So I think that illustrates a bit what you said right there.
Robert, I've got to say, we could tour two different Americas. I'll bet I could cruise through the right circles and find incredible wealth and creativity in the southern states. California is one of the world's biggest economies, and Texas is no slouch. Why do you focus on the negative? Do you think decline is greater than wealth now in America?
I found myself asking this question. I wasn't really seeking out all this stuff. I basically had a rough itinerary of locations I wanted to go to. I didn't want to take any big interstate highways. I wanted to take smaller rural routes. And I suppose psychologically, having the radio on the whole time, listening to the meltdown of General Motors, all of the environmental situations that were going on, but particularly a lot of the stuff about the economy that I was hearing just as Obama was coming in, was, I suppose, affecting my mood and temperament as I went along. And I guess the thing that I felt the further I went was that there seemed to be a real breakdown of a collective community towards trying to make change. You know, a lot of the small shops that were all there through the 50s and 60s run by mom and dad had all been closed up because of the arrival of super malls, which all of those were closing up because the infrastructure to support them wasn't there anymore. And the end result was that you have a lot of disenfranchised families and youth and families running around that are not being able to use their energies the right way. So I wasn't actively seeking out to document negative stuff. I just found it so overwhelming to find it in so many different ways.
When I drove through the southern states last, I felt the militarization of society. You see lots of guns, plenty of flags, and big bases overflowing with people in uniforms. Did you notice that as well?
Yeah, particularly the area. I actually stayed my first... After I left Miami, I drove up through Tampa, and I stayed with Chris Morris, who's the Time photographer who was covering the White House, and he'd just come from shooting the inauguration. And he's very familiar with the whole Gulf Coast area, and he'd done a few Gulf trips, road trips down through there. He's with the agency 7. And we had a long talk about basically the industries down there, and a lot of the property, a lot of the prime property locations are owned by the military, and consequently, there was a stretch of land that seemed to go for 100 miles that was just continual sort of strip malls that basically supported the people that were working in the military installations. I'd had other situations, too, that I'd go in. A couple of times I had to get new rechargeable batteries for my cameras and stuff, so I'd look for the largest Walmart I could because I figured they'd have the largest inventory of specific pieces that I needed. And in every Walmart, there was a McDonald's, and I'd go into McDonald's because you get free Wi-Fi. And in every McDonald's through the Gulf Coast area there, they'd all have a TV station on, and they would only all be on Fox TV. And I thought that's kind of interesting that if anyone gets exposure to a McDonald's, it's only one sort of media outlet saying one story the whole time. And it seemed to be a unified theme throughout all of the locations I went through the South.
Interesting. Well, it's corporate TV. Well, getting down to it, Robert Leslie, why did you call this multimedia work Storm Belt?
Well, the name was given to me. There was a British chap named Chris Boot, who was a very successful photography book publisher in the UK, and then he was asked to join the Aperture Foundation in New York. And Aperture is essentially the most important, prestigious organization in the U.S. for photography. And he was kind of brought in as a consultant on making the multimedia book. And we'd had different titles, and we ran through a lot of different things, things to do with the Empire, things to do with United, and other things to do with kind of like the loneliness of the long-distance tribe. And then he came out with this word, Stormbelt, out of the blue. And we tried it with other words before and ahead of it, but it just seemed to fit because it was actually Ed Bertinsky who gave me the history of the projections of the Sun Belt, how it was predicted to be the growth area for housing, military, agriculture. And there's been an awful lot of work done, photographically at least, on the decline of the industry of the northern U.S., the Rust Belt. But this was kind of the first kind of comprehensive view of the Sun Belt, which, you know, the Rust Belt was the 1800s and 1900s, and the Sun Belt, and I say the Rust Belt is the previous centuries, the Sun Belt was supposed to be the future century.
How do people get the book and the other files that support it?
There's initially last year I put out the iTunes version of Stormbelt, which is available on the iTunes stores. It does only work on Apple devices, which would be the iPod or the iPhone and iPad. The print book has now just been released through the British publisher Dowie Lewis. It's going to be available in North America, I think, in late January. It's already available in Europe right now. I think it can be ordered online. And I am looking at doing a version digitally on the Kindle, too, for that kind of device. So I'll have to sort of check to see what possibilities there are for that.
Is there a website for it?
Yes, there's www.storm-belt.com. It's quite simplistic. It has some aspects of the book, excerpts from the essays by Cameron and Ed, a selection of pictures, and a few links to different things on it.
It's pretty moving stuff. The book is out in Britain, Stormbelt, and it's coming soon in America. They say images speak louder than words. These ones shout about the way things are going in the southern states, I think. Robert Leslie, thank you for talking with us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure, Alex. Thanks.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. You can find more links in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. We can only lie to ourselves so long. It's been a fib fest of climate denial and economic black magic. When reality strikes, our confidence-building scripts won't cut it. We become part of nature or fail and fall. What is your decision? I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening. Grab our past programs free at the website, ecoshock.org. Please tune in again next week for more Radio EcoShock.
Tuned into KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Can't get good reception of KBOO on your radio? Just type in www.kboo.fm on your PC or laptop and click on Listen Live. We're just a mouse click away.
Hi, this is Kendall Boyson, professional life and recovery coach, and you're listening to Encouragementology, the practice of instilling hope.
Hi there. Thanks for joining me.
On this show, we are checking the emotional chart, circling the face that closely describes how we're feeling as we attempt to solve the conundrum about dissatisfaction, trend or choice. What do you think? Are you choosing to be dissatisfied, purposely turning your smile upside down and avoiding any joy as you struggle to remain unhappy? Maybe you don't know what I'm talking about, and that's great. It means you're in the shrinking percentage of people who are actually satisfied with their life, personal and professional. But if not, let's get to the root of it. What gives? Benjamin Franklin said, "Let thy discontents be thy secrets. If the world knows them, 'twill despise thee and increase them." I tend to agree. Discontentment can spread like a nasty infection. Someone who's mildly discontented needs little push over the edge to full-on dissatisfaction. And what does that get you? In my personal opinion, it makes a very large hole that is harder, if not possible, to crawl out of. Ever heard misery loves company? If the bandwagon passes by, let it pass, instead of flagging it down. First and foremost, happiness and satisfaction are conscious choices. Will there be trials and tribulations? Of course. But what lies behind you and what lies in front of you pales in comparison to what lies inside of you, said Ralph Waldo Emerson. Whether you're curious or frustrated by the situation that surrounds us, let's take some time to figure some things out. I, for one, choose happiness. Now, I don't have a t-shirt or a wall hanging or a pillow that expresses these sentiments, but it's just who I am, and I've said it over and over again. It's purely selfish. I hate to be in a bad mood. I really do. I don't mind an occasional sad day. You know, the kind where you like to eat really bad food for you, maybe stay in bed, have people wait on you and feel sorry for you. I do like those days every now and then. But the majority, 99.9% of the time, I like to be in a good mood. So if I can't fix it, I just let it go. So anytime I run across an issue, I do have a moment of problem solving. Sometimes it's longer than a moment, but I initially try to figure out what can I do to get over, around, under, however I'm going to deal with this challenge. If I find out that it's out of my control, nothing that I can actually impact in any way, then I just let it go. Now, some people think that's crazy. I just let it roll off my back, but it's purely selfish. I don't like to be in a bad mood. I don't like to be down. I don't like to hold grudges. I don't like to be angry. I just don't. Now, some people do, and they hold on to that anger as this badge of honor. You know, I'm doing something about it because I'm mad, and I'm gonna make everybody else mad. I want everybody else to feel what I'm feeling and take it seriously and stand behind me. Negativity spreads like wildfire. I've already said it, misery loves company. But imagine how quickly negativity can spread. So sometimes when I talk about energy and your ability to share energy and impact other people. It's one of those things that we don't even really think about. We just do it. And it can impact somebody in a positive or a negative way. So think about it. You're having a good day. You're choosing happiness. You wake up. This is how you're going to be today. Everything that you see is slanted with that idea. If something looks wrong, you're looking for the right. You're turning your frown upside down, and you're trying to see the positive aspects of everything. Then you meet someone. They're kind of on the fence. They're not really feeling it today. They're sort of in the middle. And you have a chance to spread sunshine, as crazy as that sounds. You can really impact their day, totally change their trajectory just by picking them up and spreading your positivity. Now you go back along your day, maybe spreading more to other people, but that person that you've just turned around for the day is also sharing it. Think about how quick that can catch fire. Now, in the same aspect, you can share it negatively. So if you're harnessing all this negative energy, you're mad about it, you're just ruminating over it, you know you can't fix it, it doesn't matter, you're just mad. And you share that with the person that's on the fence. Well, now you got a bad buddy who's now sharing that negativity and it's spreading faster than you can keep a hold of. Think about that. Be intentional. Also, if you're not feeling well, pick yourself up by picking others up. Serving others in a positive way, whether it's just eye contact and a smile, opening a door for someone, helping somebody with a project, or something even more significant, you can really turn around and lift your own spirits by helping someone else. You know, there is such power in connections. I stumbled upon that years and years ago, and I really didn't think about it. I've always been a super social person. I've always had a job where I've been out and about and meeting people, talking to people all day long. But a couple of things led up to me learning a little bit more about this. One of them was the time that I spent at the VA nursing home with my father. He was in there for about 4 years, and I was able to sit back and look around at some of the elderly adults in there and see that they really didn't have a lot of social interactions. Of course, they had the staff, which was great. And then some of them had really attentive families who would come every day for, you know, sometimes an hour or two and sometimes longer. But there were so many people that didn't have anybody. And it was very, very lonely. And I started talking to people and digging a little bit more into that because I wanted to find out why. Like, what's going on with that? How can you connect them? You know, I started thinking about not only our seniors that are in facilities, but the seniors that might have just retired. They're at home. They're trying to adjust to this retirement lifestyle, all this extra time on their hands, but yet not the same structure or routine or connections because they're not going into the office. They're not having meetings. They're not selling things. They're not inspiring or influencing decisions. They're just on their own. Now, some of these seniors have great social circles. You know, they play golf, they have dinner parties, they're involved in a lot of volunteerism. But there are some that really kept their head down and just worked their whole life, got into this routine, and then all of a sudden they look up and here they are retired, and they're not really sure what to do with their time. You know, so many times we say, gosh, when I retire, I'm going to do all this stuff because I'm going to have all this extra time. And then you find out, whoa, what do I want to do with all this extra time? And now they're struggling to have the confidence to go out and meet people and get involved, a lot of self-doubt. You know, maybe they don't want to hear from me. Maybe they don't, you know, won't value what I have to say or the input that I could give. So I think groups are important. And I've said it before, I've run a couple of support groups, Women Connect and Senior Connect, and it's all about